Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 176, Buddhism, Bias, and Racism.
Okay, greetings. I want to share today something about America. And that has to do with America and racism. Because all the disasters and the catastrophes that have been that are happening to America now are only able to happen because of racism. And I want to be clear that I don't mean that all of Trump's people are racists any more than I'm a racist. Just to be clear, I'm not saying they are racist and I'm nice, or anybody else is. The point is that there is a structural racism in our country still. We are still the privileged white people who are at home here, we feel. And we don't feel sort of on edge all the time because someone could just get us just because of who we are. Because we have been the majority, you know, race, which is an expanded definition of white, right? Originally, the Irish and the Italians, blah blah, were not white, so white is sort of like means cool, and there's a lot to do about that. I'm going to do some very longer podcasts as I get more trained, but I only want to say today that the people who are being reckless and destructive and not without realizing it, waving the American flag, are destroying America by supporting a person who is not one of them, who is the absolute capitalist class, who has been oppressing them himself totally, and in the White House is oppressing them, giving himself a tax cut and giving them no jobs program, taking away their health plan, giving them nothing actually, but they are still behind him because they don't understand that he is confusing them, that their enemies are immigrants, people who are different from them, you know, black people, Latinx people, you know, other kinds of people, and or people maybe who are gay, who are trans, who are lesbian, who are whatever, atheists, whatever it is, they're confusing them, so their actual enemy is sitting on top of them, and they are loudly supporting their enemy, this guy, who is doing the work of our international enemies, who are tired of America being the world power, such as Russia and China, and he is taking apart the system whereby we have influence over the world, and we inspire the world to try democracy and pluralism and melting pot and, you know, joy and beauty and Hollywood and whatever, you know, fantasies, Disney, right? They are destroying that. And, you know, all the while their kids are watching Disney, you know. And they're shouting about, you know, waving that red, white, and blue flag. You know, the white is only one third of the flag. The red is the native people. The blue is really black. You know, dark blue and black is really the same thing. So that is the real essence of America, is the meeting of those three races. And there really should be a little yellow border if we were smart. We would know about that, but we don't know that. You know, that's the Chinese type of people, you know. And in esoteric Buddhist teaching, you know, the Kalachakra Buddha has black face, red face, white face, and a yellow face. the black one can merge with dark blue, you know. And so those are the colors of the races on the planet, the main ones. You know, there's sort of grays and browns in between, but those are the main ones. And when everybody can identify with all of them as a human being, it's when we will have reached Shambhala, actually. That's really what it means. The fact that, and this is a little maybe over the head of some people, it might be strange, the idea that, but you know, meditate yourself as being black until you sort of feel what it feels like. It's really nearly impossible if you're white or red or yellow. But if you try it and you develop strong concentration, you can develop your empathy. You can develop the resilience of identity. You won't be so rigid in your sense of identity. Anyway, the structural definition of racism just means that we still benefit, we inherit, we feel at home, comfortable on the street. We don't feel nervous. Well, we do feel nervous when we see a cop because we often are speeding, but we don't feel nervous just being law-abiding and just because we have the wrong skin color in this country. And we could be beaten up and could be killed, actually, just from driving down the street if we sort of looked the wrong way or had the wrong tone of voice or whatever it was. Some bad guy was in a bad mood. Then when you live in a country like that, you feel insecure all the time. And you are insecure. And you have worse education and worse livelihood and everything is worse lifespan, life expectancy, worse health care. I mean, you're generally worse off. And so in the sense that we feel comfortable in that kind of culture, I read this work by a lady named D'Angelo, who's a sociologist, and she called it, it's a book about white fragility, about how whites have difficulty facing the structural racism that they are all participant in. We are all participant in. I'm one of them. Although I like to say that I feel I'm pink rather than white. I think that people are blotchy pink, people who have less pigment in their skin because of living in a northern climate. But that's just a joke, you know. And I also profit and privilege and benefit by the whiteness, you know. And my ancestors had slaves, and my ancestors, you know, like, created this situation. But there is the ideal.
There you go.
However, you know, so my ancestors created this, and their houses were built by slaves, and their white house was, and that, you know, we should, this white house is an abomination. Jesse Jackson was absolutely right. He wanted to paint it rainbow colors, like that bridge in the Golden Gate Bridge off San Francisco. He wanted to paint it multicolored, make it more cheerful. Like, you know, the Parthenon in ancient Greece was painted in many colors. We have this stupid idea about the Greeks that everything was all, you know, lily white, but it wasn't. It was multicolored. And, you know, they have painted those things, but the paint has worn off. You know? So we just paint with white paint. That's silly. You know, but it was because the way they were when we started this country. But at least there is the ideal that there should be equality, that there could be something like a civil rights movement, that there was Reconstruction before it was undone by the evil people of the last part of the 19th century putting up those statues. And they tried to put the Jim Crow thing back, and they put in Jim Crow laws. And we still like to have Jim Crow in prison, too many black people in prison, because we didn't educate them, didn't allow them an equal housing and livelihood and education, and therefore more of them were desperate, and therefore they were more arrested rather than educated. And that's really terrible. And the prisons don't even educate them, just punish them and torture them in subtle ways, and not so subtle ways. So we really have to cure this racism thing so that everyone will be sensible and harmonious. And, you know, all of the things we invented here in America, and actually our victory even in wars had to do with the fact that somehow all our people, like the Japanese in the last World War, they fought in our army, even though we arrested all their families in a racist suspicion of them, which we didn't do to the Germans and the Italians, although the Mussolini and Hitler were also our enemy, not only Tojo. But we only arrested all the Japanese, because they look different because of racism. So we do these confused and irrational things. But we won the wars because everybody joined. You know? You know, we had anti-Semitic country clubs and golf courses and universities and what have you. And yet the Jews fought in the war for us. And then later we might think, oh, we want to save the Jews from the Nazis, but that isn't the case. Our whole country was full of Nazis herself. But they still fought in our war. Because of this one thing, we have this ideal that we should try to get over this kind of thing. Get over this rigidness of identity. And this D'Angelo book called about white fragility and about racism and how to deal with it, and her brave work is to go and consult for companies that want more creativity, so they want to get over the racism and so on, or they want to try to ameliorate it, at least lessen it. And that's a constant work. It's something that's been in place for centuries, and so it takes time. We still have it. Even those of us who are very liberal, and if we misunderstand racism, she brilliantly analyzes how people misunderstand, thinking that it's something a bad person has because they act in some bad way. But she doesn't. That's not what it really means. What it means is participant in a system that is bad. And then within the system that is bad, there are those who think the system was great, and they're completely trapped by it. And they're the ones who we're not saying that liberal people or progressive people are like that. They're not. But even they are participant in the system, is what she's making the point. And if we want the ones who are acting bad to overcome their confusion, we have to work on ourselves again and again, more and more, of overcoming our structural racism, which is the system which we do participate in, all of us. And it's brilliant what she does, and it's very courageous, because what she calls white fragility is where we don't really want to face the system. I myself, reading her book, I was suddenly thinking, you know, there are some Thurmans who had plantation in Mississippi, and that's terrible. But I didn't inherit that plantation. They got wasted in the Civil War, and they're all poor. And, you know, there are lots of black Thurmans, but I haven't managed to find them. And maybe I'll try, you know. I always have thought I should try, but I never got around to it because of my own struggle to survive as an intellectual, you know, as a humanist intellectual in a country that doesn't prize knowledge, doesn't prize humanism, actually underpays its school teachers, you know. And now we've come to a very dangerous position. I'm very optimistic, though, because I really think that what has happened, what this guy is just a crook, you know, who got into deciding to use the U.S. government for his crimes, you know, and somehow managed to confuse by bringing out the worst in people who were the most confused, but doing what all the previous his predecessors have done to a lesser extent with their dog whistling and so on. Since Reagan, especially intensively, but and since the Southern Strategy by Nixon in the late 60s, you know, he's just taken that to the extreme, of using race, you know, overt race or, you know, focused conscious race to confuse poor people, who are actually being oppressed by their own people of their own race, who are using this system to suppress their own poor white people, in fact. And by confusing them that race is the problem, they are able to oppress them even more to a revolutionary point where they actually will turn their guns on the government, will have a civil war if it could go on. But luckily, I think it won't go on because we have this ideal, and I think we will adopt this work. But I think we liberals, who progressives, who are going to vote right in the coming struggle in a few months, we should also be working on ourselves in that other way, on a vast scale. And by reading her book, you can realize that this is not being done on a vast scale, unfortunately, this struggle against structural racism. It is not. I am still too ignorant about it. And we are still too sort of sticky to really face up to it. We're too fragile. We must do it. It's very critical. It's part of the inner work that will go with the outer work of getting back a more decent government. Okay? So this is not a real whole thing about that. It's just getting started in that. But I think this is really, really important. And for example, in Buddhism, There's, you know, you go to Buddhist centers and there's very few black meditators and teachers. And that's wrong. And Native Americans, you could count on the one finger. And that's not correct, because they think of it, of course, as a religion, and they have their religion, and they don't want to get involved with that. And they've rebelled against Christianity to Islam quite a lot, which is right, which is fine, but in a way, ignoring that the people who sold them to the Christian ship captains were usually Muslim. But everyone is guilty of it all. That's okay. So, but the point is, that's really bad, and we should really work on that. And I have been, you know, doing too many jobs and saving Tibet and teaching at the university and trying to build up a thing to save the Tibetans and so forth. And I haven't done enough in this other direction about our own country. And I really must do that. You know, I've had the resolution to do it for some time, but I haven't done it. But now I'm going to get going on doing it. And I'm going to right away do it through podcasting, getting Buddhist people or whoever watches my podcast into it with me. We really have to look at it. And the first step might be look at this book on white fragility by D'Angelo. And the first name is, it's in the phone because I have it on the Kindle. It's something D'Angelo.
We'll put the link in the podcast.
Okay. But that's a very important book. I really admire her work. I need to be in her workshops to have it more applied to myself. But I don't pretend I know it all, that thing. On the other hand, last thing, there is something that Buddhism can contribute that isn't just meditation to this question, which has to do with Buddhism's consummate psychology about identity formation, identity boundary expanding, identity transformation, and how identity is structured, formed, recreated, the impermanence of identity, the ability to achieve resilience of identity and overcome such fragility and so forth, sort of a broader thing like that. This would be very helpful in this sort of broad-scale education and therapy about this. But first I need to work on it more myself, just in what they have going, and then figure out how to fit the Buddhist thing more with it, the scientific Buddhist thing, not religion, scientific Buddhist thing. And that I vow to do. And I promise you more podcasts in that direction, okay? Thank you very much. All the best.
Greetings and salutations, podcast Wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. In the first half of this week's podcast, we got to hear Bob talk about getting woke. I'm sorry, there's no better way to put it than saying that Bob's kind of woken up to the issues that are facing our country, like many of us have. It's not just a matter of some white guy picking up the term Black Lives Matter. Bob's looking to engage his own personal bias and hopes to talk to you, his podcast listeners, students, and longtime friends here on the podcast and on the various social media platforms he's on. And if you're on Quora, be sure to check out Bob Thurman there. Bob personally is on Quora answering questions about Buddhism, life, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and the work of Tibet House, U.S. and New York City. Second half of this week's podcast is a meditation by Bob. It's one of my favorite meditations. It's a nine-breath purification meditation from the Utah tradition as taught by Dr. Nita. Now, the meditation is slightly complex, so we'll include a video in the podcast description on bobthurman.com that has Dr. Nita and some of his students demonstrating the practice. You can also find videos of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at dalailama.com of him teaching this meditation. The styles are slightly different, mostly the hand placement, but this is a practice I do daily and I find deeply beneficial. So if you're inspired by this meditation, be sure to visit bobthurman.com to see that video and find links to other resources to deepen your practice in the Utah tradition. Bob and Dr. Nita will be teaching at Menla later this year. Special thanks this week goes to Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa. Located in Phoenicia, New York, 2 hours north of New York City, it's in the heart of the Catskills and offers year-round retreats, getaways, and customized packages. So if you're looking to get away from New York City or your busy life, check us out at menla.us. There's group packages, individual getaways, and also the spaces are available for group rentals. So if you're interested in joining us in Catskills, or you've got a group event you'd like to host at Menla, please visit menla.us. If you're inspired by what you hear here, please be sure to like, subscribe, and follow on all your favorite social media platforms. Your online participation helps support the ongoing work of Tibet House US to present and preserve Tibetan culture. Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob and the second half of this week's podcast.
Okay, greetings. Now today we're going to start the meditation, and we're going to do the famous ninefold breathing. And we're going to follow Dr. Nita's way of doing it. So sit cross-legged, and back straight, chin a little tucked, but not rigid, as if some string was pulling you up by the crown of your head. And you're sort of up straight, a line from the pelvis all the way to the spine. Then imagine that you have your central channel going from the third eye level, but a little bit back where the two nostril passages go toward the sinuses. And that's the opening is there. And then it goes up to the crown of your head. And then it goes straight down, slightly in front of the spine, down through the neck vertebrae, the cervical vertebrae, then down in front of the, between the two lungs, sort of just near the heart, but in the center, and then down past the navel, and then down to the perineum, and then forward to the tip of the female clitoris or the penis, either one. And then next to it, starting at the two nostrils, on the right is a red channel, and on the left is a white channel, and it goes up, and it goes right next to the blue one, which is all the way back, although it's dark red inside. And then it goes all the way down with it, and don't meditate with the knots at each chakra point level. Just meditate them as going straight down, smaller, a little bit smaller than the central channel. Central channel like a big straw for a milkshake, and the right and left one a little bit smaller, like a regular straw. And then take your right hand, and actually your left hand, and close your left nostril. And inhale with your right hand, when sort of one, your index finger extended, lift up as you breathe in and through the right nostril, up to the level of your forehead, and have the air go right into the right red channel, up to the crown, down, all the way down the red channel, and then into fitting into the white channel below the opening of the blue channel, four fingers below the navel. So that's like a coupling, like a plumbing coupling, but it doesn't go into the blue channel at first. It goes straight into the left white channel. Okay? So inhale on the red channel, bringing your finger up in front of your face, and then let the finger go down again to your lap,
sort of signaling that the wind is going down the right-hand red channel, opening it up like down through a balloon, and any little kink in it sort of smoothing out and coming to the inhale just below the opening of the central channel and holding just for a little second. And then move your, bring your right hand up and close your right nostril and exhale through the left, coming up the left white channel, the air, and going up to the crown and then down and out the left nostril. Slowly exhale. Then, and as you exhale, bring it down, wave down your left hand from where it had been holding the left nostril shut, and have it go down, and then bring it up slowly, like you're filling up the white channel. Okay, then inhale through the white channel, waving the hand over and down, and then bring it up, filling up the white channel. Hold that. Exhale through the right red channel, moving the right hand down and up. Then inhale through the right red channel, holding it down below the navel. And then shift the hands and exhale through the left channel. And again, inhale the left channel, holding it down below the opening of the central channel, and exhale through the right channel, shifting the nostrils being closed by the different fingers. And you do that three times on each side. And then you inhale through both nostrils. You can stop and blow your nose if it gets congested. And then continue. And then inhale through both nostrils. And then feel that it goes down the right and left channels to the opening. And then now the two channels both fit into the bottom of the central channel, back toward the back of the pelvic bone, above the perineum, four fingers below the navel. And then exhale strongly through the mouth as if it was coming up the blue central channel, up over the top, and then down to the sort of third eye, but then down to the mouth, and just going just again, inhale through both, down the right and left channels, then up through the blue channel. As you're holding, let the well up into through the blue channel, then flowing out. Third time, down there to the base, to the, now we have a triple, double plumbing thing where the right and left, the red right and the left white go into the blue center channel. Then, okay. So that's called the ninefold, and it clears and balances your winds so that when you do any other meditation, you can have a kind of concentration. But now that you've opened these different channels, we're going to do a little meditation about that. And well, let's go back now to being in your coarse body, that is the body with your skin, which is your touch sense organ, with your eyes, ears, nose, nostrils, and tongue, five senses, and the mental sense inside, more in the heart center than in the brain center. But so you're in that, and then you do the four signs of getting out of the coarse body, which you know by heart by now, which are earth into water, with things becoming an inner experience of like a swirling, your eyes are mostly closed, a swirling feeling in your third eye, internally, imaginative vision, like a hallucination or a mirage. Then water into fire, then you have a smoky feeling, like your inside is all smoke, and you're sort of losing track of having your skin and your sense, your coarse body with limbs and so on. And then water into into fire, right? Then fire into wind. And so then there's this cooling sensation, and you have a sense of swirling fireflies. Actually, no, you have the fireflies and or sparks when you go from the smoke. You sort of get to the point of fire, and you have, and then as it cools, it turns from sparks, reddish sparks, into greenish firefly swarm as you come to wind. And it swirls around very strongly inside, and you have kind of, you don't really feel a difference between inside and outside of your body. You have a very light feeling of anything touching you if you're sitting on the floor. You don't feel heavy, you feel like you're floating. And then you go from wind into space / disembodied consciousness with the symbol of a candle flame burning very, very still, a gentle whitish light that's very, very still. And that expands into sort of a general space filled of moonlight. Sort of it stays on a border between the candle flame and a sort of expanded space of moonlight. And where you are is you are at the boundary between the coarse and subtle body-mind in the state, edge of the state of luminance, and which is boundaried by the state of internally boundaried, experientially boundaried by the state of candle flame. Now, be aware of a new body. Your new body is just your nervous system, actually. Your central channel becomes your body, like the axis of it. The right and left channels go down next to it, and we'll imagine for the moment they are not looped and knotted around it, except perhaps at the level of the heart chakra, which is sort of right where the little floating bone is at the breastbone, which is sort of the height of the middle of the heart. And going back to one of the vertebrae, I forget which one. And leave a little bit of a knot there, because there's a little bit of a, like a little, tiny little ball there. And then you're a bundle of luminous fibers. Your white moonlit space corresponds to a body, which is your whole nervous system, which branches off that central channel in the right and left channel. And there are particular branch-offs right under the surface of your skull in a crown chakra, where you sort of think of it as an umbrella with lotus petals branching out, with channels in the center of those lotus petals, and sort of going, shaping down like a dome. And you sort of think of it out to 32 petals. But that's not the end of it, because then those petals go into like nerve fibers that all throughout your brain. So your brain is all lit up like a Christmas tree with these 32 petals coming off that central channel. And remember, the central channel and the right and left red and white channels, they go up the front of the skull, sort of just under that dome, and then they come down, or just above that dome, those petals, and then they come down right to the center of the petal where the pericarp of the flower would be if it was a lotus. The nerve lotus. And then if you go down the central channel, there's a 16-petal throat lotus, which is an upside-down umbrella, and also many nerve endings going off that in the throat area. And remember, you don't really think of the usual skin, flesh, blood, and bone. You're just kind of an area of this bundle of fibers. And Then you go further down and you have an eight-petal umbrella facing downward at the heart level with a lot of, but then actually it goes out to 24 and 72. It's the biggest complex, actually, at the heart center. And then you go down further and you have a 64-petal lotus, which is an upside-down umbrella at the navel center. And then if you include the fifth chakra, the genital chakra, which includes the genital organ and also the bottom of the central channel before it hooks up into the genital organ. And there you have 32 petals facing downward, outward, like a also blossoming lotus. And you can even do little ones at the tip, and it's all software. So don't worry that it's exactly this or that. But you are the bundle, you're like this spindle with these five lotuses with different levels of complexity in your mind. And in that spindle, and in that sort of bundle of fibers, there is movement, energy flows around in all this bundle of fibers. And energy pushes drops. And the drops, there's white and red drops, which are called enlightenment spirit, bodhicitta. You could call it enlightenment mind if you translate citta as mind, but I prefer spirit. And the red enlightenment spirit has a kind of central thing at the navel chakra, or below the navel chakra at the hara, what they have in martial arts called the hara. And the white is located mainly in the brain. And the white is connected to semen, but it's a sort of acted hormonal essence of semen. And it's sort of the embodiment of consciousness, these drops. They are not consciousness itself, they are body, but they are embodiment of consciousness. And the red is uterine blood, not menstrual blood. This is uterine blood when it's fertile, not after fertility has passed. But although in many tantric texts you will read menstrual blood, but this is wrong. It's better translated as uterine blood, or sometimes I like to translate it as ovum. It's connected to blood, like the white spirit of enlightenment is connected to semen. So your subtle body is this called Za Lung Tigle in Tibetan, Nadi, Vayu, and Bindu in Sanskrit. Channels, winds, and drops. And there are many different ways of working with that. But what we're going to do together is we are going to associate the white spirit of enlightenment as being connected in the center of the brain chakra to a kind of moon disk. There's like a moon disk there. And then the navel chakra, the reddish navel chakra, for the moment, we're going to think of it as a tiny little flame in the center of the central channel at the middle of the navel chakra. So a navel chakra has 64 petals, and then the center is reddish, and there's a flame there. And this flame is very intense, like a laser flame, but it doesn't go out and heat your body necessarily. It just goes very precisely like a gas jet up the central channel, and it strikes the moon disk above, and then the moon disk melts this spirit of enlightenment. And this spirit of enlightenment becomes kind of the embodiment of bliss, a little bit like orgasmic bliss. Because it is because of its association with semen. It's a male fluid of bliss, of fertility, and sort of opening molecule, that means, bliss means it's releasing molecule, or subatomic light energy even. We don't want them fixated in any particular wave or particle. But now it trickles down all through the nervous system when melted by the heat. And you can also associate the heat, the little flame, with the syllable ah, which in its shortest form, the ah, is just like a little inverted pyramid, like a stacked up fluted thing. It's like the source of the gas jet. And then the moon disc is the syllable hum. So that between aham is the word ego, or I in Sanskrit, aham. So what you are actually is this burning fire at the navel, melting this moon, cooling moon in the brain, and letting it flood through all the petals of all the chakras, 32 in the brain, 16 in the throat, 8 in the heart, 64 in the navel. We won't get into the genital one at the moment. Just those four. And you feel your body filling with the bliss energy at that heat. And now the mind of the subtle mind is the sense of being just moonlit space. You don't get too heavy about this bundle of fibers that you are. It's very, very diaphanous and transparent. And you have this, and the awareness involved with it is this broad awareness of called luminance awareness, luminosity or luminance awareness. It's this moonlit. There's no other moon. The moon is in the brain, but when you go into the consciousness side, based in that body, not a body of hands and arms and limbs and bones and flesh and blood and organs and things. You forget about all that. You're just this bundle of sensitivities, channels, filling with bliss. And you're in this moon state. And as you're in moon state, your consciousness moves from your brain area, where it all often is associated with your visual field, where we often are in our culture. And it kind of, as far as sort of a point of subjective view, it sort of slowly flows down the central channel, like a little drop trickling down the central channel. And it lands in the heart center, which is the center of the heart chakra in the central channel, at the height of the chakra. A little globule, a little node there, like a little ball goes into a little like charm, like a baseball or softball. And part of this outside of the softball is this white thing. And you go inside the white thing. Then you then move your consciousness down to the flame in the reddish navel area. And then you move into a more heat. Your field becomes a sunlit space. And you feel more hot. And you, in a way, you expand way beyond skin. But in another way, you go into the, you move in the central channel, you bring up that heat from up the central channel into the heart center in a reddish, but the awareness is a reddish glow that is not limited to any channel or body or anything. It's a reddish infinite space. And then, so then you're kind of a red, and the red and the white make a kind of wonderful little capsule. But round capsule at your heart. And then you bravely go inside that capsule to rest, because it's a little, that's called radiance, that state. The reddish state is a radiant state, like a sun-like state. So the sun and moon meet at your heart center, kind of, in a blissful feeling. And you feel so blissful, you kind of almost want to pass out. And then you go into a darkness, and you almost like go to sleep, something like that. And then you go to an infinitesimal size. You make your mental concentration of the point of the heart center become like a super electron microscope. that goes down and sees through anything at any large size, and it's like a tiny little thing there. And then you go almost unconscious, it's so small. It's at some point like a mustard seed, sometimes even smaller, but you're inside it, not outside. So you're inside the union of the red and white into the blue, and the blue becomes black, darkish red and then black. And you let yourself feel almost unconscious, but you try to sit up straight and sort of just let go of everything. And then what happens is very strange. From sort of having gone into a total micro, below the wave particle paradox, suddenly you're in a pre-dawn twilight moment. And it's a grayish transparency which expands infinitely. And yet you're very calm and completely, it's almost like you're both conscious and unconscious at the same time. You're a point of awareness at the center of a vast transparent space of clear light transparency, gray twilight transparency, a kind of twilight because there's no darkness and there's no brightness. Everything is transparent. But there's no size. So you are suddenly everywhere in that transparency. Your awareness is both micro and macro at the same time. You're in an inexpressibly blissful state. You have sort of disappeared past unconsciousness into kind of super conscious and super still, while yet still unconscious. Diamond light and yet not the opposite of darkness. So therefore, of course, inexpressible. So as we do this meditation, we identify with and we think of the great Tsongkhapa in 1398 as he was in the Yamatung cave on Udel Gungel Mountain above Olka Valley, all alone. And when he had that great dream, he also reached a point where undoubtedly he was in the embodiment of the Akshobhya Vajra, in the center of the third 32 deity esoteric community mandala. And he had wisdom, or what I call intuition hero consort, subtle body consort, Sparsha Vajra, but not a human consort. Because he wanted to remain a monk. And so he did dissolve everything into the central channel. And he did get to the point of rising in the magic body, but he held himself short of that, slightly, because he didn't want to renounce his monkhood, because it would be the wrong thing to manifest to all the many inspired Tibetan women and men who were feeling themselves in the field of fruition, inspired by his presence and by his vision of the immanence, the immanent with an A, an immanent presence of Shakyamuni Buddha, Vajradhara Buddha, realizing that the sphere of the land of Tibet and the people of Tibet was a place where full enlightenment could be attained. Fully enlightened beings were utterly present. It was not a time of, he canceled the Kali Yuga, this age of degeneration, within the sort of special bubble that he created in the high mountain fastness on the roof of the world. He did create that in order to radiate Tibet like a kind of great lighthouse of swirling, brilliant, primal light rays, the brilliant diamond white light of the mirror-like wisdom, the golden shining red light of the wisdom of equality, the brilliant ruby light of the wisdom of individual creativity, the emerald green light of all-accomplishing energy, and then the deep, dark, blue-black light of the ultimate reality perfection. So we are tasting this now ourselves. And it is always there in us, at the center of our heart chakra, in the central channel. It's always constantly there. So when we conclude this kind of meditation, where you go kind of spaced out in the subtle mind, in your body of channels, winds, and drops, and you space out in the subtle mind of the white light, moonlight, the red light, sunlight, the dark light, immanence of luminance, radiance, and immanence, and then into the threshold states of the clear light, transparency, twilight, where you're sort of infinitesimal and you have withdrawn completely from any coarse reality. You're like a subatomic Samantabhadra being. And then you're a wave being which is everywhere. So you're vast everywhere and you're permeating, however, all things. You're not some everywhere where it's a vast space where things are not seeable, other beings are not sensible. You feel all of them there. They are transparent. And you see it all as an oceanic space of bliss and freedom. Emptiness is the freedom. And bliss is the release into the freedom. Bliss, void, indivisible is what it's called. So, but then you can backtrack from that and you can reestablish. Then you see yourself. You see, when you fully go into, why do you need a consort? It isn't just to have sex. When you take a human consort, the two of you are just sitting in a yogic posture, each one in an exquisite mental stillness, already only into subtle body, leaving the coarse body in union, like what they call father-mother union. They don't call it lover-lover union. They call it father-mother union. And so you need that father-mother union when you really go out into the vast, infinite, clear light space in order to return to be reborn in your ordinary coarse body and to take up having a coarse consciousness, sixfold consciousness of the five sense consciousness of visual, audio, olfactory, gustatory, and tactile, and then your mental sixth consciousness. In order to come back to inhabit that, you have to have a mother and father. So in a way, you take rebirth in your own body as a male and female, which you are two in one, one in two. And that's the point of these Yab-Yum father-mother figures and father-mother embodiments that you have learned to develop and very stably visualize yourself as in the creation stage. And then at a certain point in the perfection stage, you need a partner who ultimately, who is a female who has done the same study, who has the same centrism, the same prasangika. If you're a female, you need a male. And then the two of you have to reach the same point together, which is not just having ordinary sex at all. It's a yogic union of extreme delicacy and sensitivity. In a completely divine body, which you can see if you just look at the sadhana in the essential Tibetan Buddhism, that are the sort of partial translation of the esoteric community sadhana is just an example. You must not try this actually, even with a visionary consort, either male or female, depending on which side you want to make your principle. Until you have been initiated. You can fool with it, but it won't really get anywhere. And in a way, it's considered bad luck, because you won't really get anywhere, then you'll be discouraged and think it's impossible. And in fact, some people will say it is impossible, and you shouldn't even try and even think about this kind of thing, until you've gone off and developed one-pointed shamatha mental expertise up through the nine stages, where you can hold your mind fixed on a single point for 2 hours without a single distracting thought, or losing vividness of that whatever the object in your mind is, a little golden Buddha in your mind's eye, seen with the third eye, which is a thing you often do, or just a spot of gold, or just like the indestructible drop in your heart center, or whatever it is that you're meditating. And then they discourage us from doing that, but that's not, they're actually wrong. Because you can get initiated and you can develop a sadhana and very, very humbly and patiently recite, even maybe memorize to a short form. And then when you do that, you will accelerate your process towards shamatha, actually, and you will be developing shamatha in your holding of any detail of the mandala or any detail of your deity body much faster than you would in doing sort of an exoteric Shambhala, like just hold your mind on a blue dot press or on a golden Buddha body process. And you're developing vipassana, which is where you scan around the mandala and you see the structure and you see the Buddhas in every atom of the mandala, etc., etc., and you sort of scan the deeper, miraculous flower ornament reality of the relative universe. There, that's your, and you see it all as manifestations of emptiness, of clear light. And that's your vipassana. And if you do that in this context, it accelerates. And it, automatically your understanding on the philosophical coarse body-mind level, conceptual mind level, it will facilitate and accelerate that. So you don't have to sort of sit back and say, well, I won't try this until I've done that to the ultimate. You can go back and forth, but you can, it's not wrong to do the other, of course, but you know, don't like say, oh, this is the only thing and that is the only thing. And different people have different affinities. Some of you may indeed have achieved shamatha in previous life. It will slowly and eventually happen. You familiarize yourself. You realize these things bit by bit, first as an imaginative, unstable thing, and eventually stable and vivid, one-pointed vision, where you're really experiencing yourself as a being with a triple shoulder and three arms and three faces or whatever it is that you're doing. Okay, Om Shunyata Jnana Vajra Svabhavatma Koham. I will explain that again in the next meditation. And for the moment, dedicate the merit of whatever meditation you did in following this to quickly attaining the state of Manjushri and Tsongkhapa yourself, becoming a Losang Dakpa yourself. And then in order to install all beings in their own Tsongkhapa and Losang Dakpa and Buddhahood as rapidly as possible. Salutations.
Thanks for tuning in this week. And as a special bonus, I'll be posting the full, unedited, nine-fold breath meditation that Bob recorded that's a little bit longer than the second half of this podcast would allow. So be sure to visit bobthurman.com later this week and subscribe on your favorite social media platforms. If you'd like to reach me, Justin Stone Diaz, I can be found on most social media platforms as Justin Stoned. I can also be emailed directly at justin@menla.org. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Dalek.